what I would like to ask is really which piece of work you're still particularly proud of, and also which particular piece of work maybe you wish you hadn't written, or that most embarrasses you now.
It all embarrasses me. I don't quite know what to say. I've done different kinds of things, and that's what I don't quite... I've done a lot of essays, but, I mean, more than most anthropologists, I think, do, or at least they're more than they're used to, and less monographic writing. So I have written monographs. I wrote Groups of Java, which is the start of the monograph. But in general, I haven't done a lot of monographic work. There's a lot of work that I think was okay in its time, but is now sort of obsolescent, most of it, but Peddler's Prince, things like that, you know, I think they probably were of a time and had a point in their time, but have very little now. Long run, I guess the more substantive works that I'm most proud of, Groups of Java, Agricultural Revolution, the Gara, the Sukh, which has just been translated into French, sort of forgotten. Those are more substantial works. And then, but as I say, there's that kind of work, and then there's the essay work, which has been much more speculative and more literary and more general. I don't know that I want to disown any of my work, though I wouldn't write a lot of it over again today. But I like work in general, not my only mine, but anybody's, which combines a fair amount of empirical material with some analytic speculative theoretical conception. I don't write much pure theory. I've written very little, a few papers, but not books. I'm not much for pure monographic writing. Religion Java is closest to that, but even that is full of all kinds of ideas. So I don't do much of that. I don't know what to say. I'm embarrassed to talk about giving A's B's to my own work.
If it doesn't for listening, I mean, you've rarely answered critics. Some anthropologists kind of make a point of, like, for example, Marshall Sahlins more recently and his multiple spats with Opus Acre. But you've very rarely bothered to...
I don't like the loving. I never have. But what I think sometimes people don't realize they've been replied to. that it is there, and it isn't... You may see that a little bit in the Strezza lecture where I make some backhand. I tend to give people an elbow as I go by rather than actually taking them under. And it's true, I don't care for polemic. I really have never liked it.
Yeah. I mean, even the one time that you did when you wrote that essay on agricultural revolution, 20 years after, or whatever it was called. I mean, even that wasn't polemical.
No, and I didn't. And that is an exception. It's one of the few times I actually thought that I would take on a set of criticisms and trying to at least deal with them. But no, I don't do that. I have a kind of the caravan moves on, the dog's bark sort of approach to things. I just want to keep going, and people can make their comments. And as I say, I reply more than people think, but it's not usually in the... Marshall, of course, and Dobie too, but both of them are... They're bulldogs, and they really like that sort of thing. And I'm not, I have nothing against it, but it's not my style. My style is to go forward and try to think and to deal with these things. But I have often been criticized for not directly responding to critics. But that's sort of backward looking, and I really just don't. Part of it is by the time I finish something, I'm so exhausted with it, I don't really want to think about it for another 20 years. I really don't think much. I had some polemics with Ernest. I mean, he and I.
Yes, exactly.
We got along well, Ernest and I personally, but we didn't agree on about anything. The last time, it's in an obscure place, but this is a place where I really had a polemic against Ernest. Ernest was there. This was in Hilversum in Holland. It's been published in an obscure place. I don't know if any of you have seen it. But Ernest had just published, I'm just giving this an example, one of the few times that I consider myself to have been in a full polemic mode. Ernest had just published this book about attacking postmodernism and making me the origin of all modern evil, and I stood up and had a, you know, and he was very nice, you know, he He was there, and we both were polemical. And as I got along, I could do better with him because I liked him. But that's rare for me. I really just don't do it. I really don't. I'm more interested in trying to construct things that sort of looking backwards doesn't have much appeal to me. But it is a critique that's often made of me, and it's probably got some grounds to it that I should spend more time dealing with people who don't agree with me. But I just have very little interest in doing it. I'm more interested in trying to get on with something else. I don't know what else to say about that.
But in Available Light, a lot of the essays, especially at the beginning, like anti-relativism and a couple of you're actually engaging with the kinds of wars, the culture wars, the science wars, and all of that. And while you don't take a polemical stance so much in that, it's something that's obviously you're very aware of, sort of charting. I was wondering, I was looking at it again over the weekend, and one gets the sense that especially on this side of the Atlantic, or at least in British social anthropology, that some of these fights haven't been quite so entrenched or as deep as they have been in the States. I don't know if that's entirely
true. That's interesting. I've always had the feeling it was worse here. I mean, I'd be right. I mean, I just wonder about perceptions. I have a feeling that if I might say so, British social anthropology in the past, not now so much, but in the past was much more bloody-minded than American, but that may not be true. It's certainly my perception, and that's part of the reason why I avoid polemic. I don't like to get... I always was, let me just be frank, I always was annoyed with Edmund, not because he attacked me, because he didn't much, but because he attacked everybody, that he generally was in that kind of mode. And I felt that really wasn't, especially when we beat up on younger people, I didn't like it. But in general, he had such an intensely polemic. I understand it too. I mean, I think of a number of, and I never cared for it. I didn't think of anthropology as a blood sport as a very attractive idea. Now, that may be unfair to say it's here worse than there, because you just established some tremendous polemics in the United States, you're quite right. Well, I don't know whether it's worse there or worse here or better here or better there or whatever, but I do think that tonality of anthropology, which has been marked, has always put me off a bit. I'm more interested in not. I mean, there was tremendous struggles over this and that. I really don't know what to say. But you're right, it's certainly, I don't want to plead innocent to, you know, ever having any opinions that. Certainly, anti-relativism would distinctly attempt to get at some people. I mean, not so much my name, I didn't have to Bell and Spiro and a few others, but I really, you know, it was an attempt to set out a position, so I don't want to be such a, you know, innocent sweetheart guy. I don't claim that. But in general, I'm more interested in trying to get it's clear that I'm not neutral in this issue. I'm on the one side.
I wonder whether I can press you a bit on that, because it seems to me that, I mean, an easy analysis would be to simply divide it into two. But of course, I was quite interested when you said that you liked writing which combined empirical material with a bit of theory, so that, I mean, we can actually locate these divisions within the ranks of those who would put themselves on the sides of arts, too, as well as...
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But the division you're talking about is a different one, and it's... One side, and the side I'm on, is blobby. I mean, it's just everybody and doing different kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the... And I say you get a past view of this, but the people I think of as... evolution as a cosmos, about the biological terms. They're very solitary. They're very, so it's them versus the whole situation. Which doesn't mean necessarily they're wrong or right, but it does mean that the two sides are not sides. There's this very, they remind me, actually, because I'm older than most of you, I can remember when the Marxists were like this. They came to meetings and stayed late, too. I mean, the same business. Yeah. They worked very hard. The controversy that you might have seen most recently, which, I mean, being to think of it, it's true, the American anthropology perhaps is more torn now, the British. The Napoleon Chagnon business,
oh, yes,
about Prime,
Chagnon,
which
yes,
I wrote
yes,
about
yes,
in that time.
Yes.
But that was an example. When the, again, the, leaving aside who's right and who's wrong in this issue, you know, the mobilization of writing and of force and so on both sides was enormous, and especially on this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that within, after Tierney's book, before Tierney's book was published, they just flooded the emails, I mean, flooded the internet with
mm-hmm.
polemic of various sorts. I mean, people found it and so. So, yeah, you do have that. I mean, that's an example of a kind of... It's not like the old battles that I was talking about where people just didn't get along and just...
Mm-hmm.
This is a kind of a metaphysical ultimate battle of some sort. I mean,
yeah.
it takes on, and it can take on those tonalities. So it's very hard to sort of find it. But I certainly agree that on the other side, it's not a side. It's a mishmash.
It's an amorphous group.
Yeah. So what you have is an amorphous, which anthropology has always been, in my view, and perhaps in my view will stay there, but whether that's true or not,
mm-hmm.
is amorphous. And then you have a very tight marching society, which
sure.
is very strong, knows what it thinks, argues what it thinks, is mobilized to do
mm-hmm.
things, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
At least I think it's a problem.
But they seem to have an axe to grind with your notion of interpretation, all these people.
They
have an axe to grind about interpretation.
Well, yes,
and they seem to still respect the way you talk about interpretation.
I guess. I don't know who they are. It's coming who...
The people of the evolutionary...
Yeah, I don't see that they have much interest in what I'm doing, but maybe they do. I don't know quite what to say. They ought not to, because I really am troubled. At least I would like to be, to the general sort of assumptions under which they operate. But I don't really know. But this is a, you're quite right, it is a very strong difference. In
yeah.
I also am outside the general, this is something that, and I always have been, largely outside the structure of power in American anthropology, because I wanted to be in that.
Yeah.
I've hardly been in the anthropology department. I was an undergraduate, not in anthropology, then I went to Harvard into social relations, which was integrated thing, is now long gone, but it was a great thing while it lasted, at least I thought it was. I then, you know, I was much of the time in the field. When I wasn't in the field, I was at Chicago for about a year or two, but the only time I've ever been really in the anthropology department was a couple of years at Berkeley. I went to Chicago, but there wasn't really mainly in the anthropology department. I was, got an appointment in it, but I was mainly in the Nations Committee working on that. And then I went to the Institute for Advanced Study, where I've only been the only anthropologist for 35 years. So I'm not part of, by wish, I mean, it's not that I've been excluded or if you have any reason, of the structure, the bureaucratic structure of American anthropology, intellectual structure at all. So I'm a kind of frontier in all this, and I try to operate that way.
What was your... I don't know how to really phrase this because it's possibly slightly naive, but it's seen from across the herring pond. It sometimes seems that your own writings unleashed a tiger, which perhaps you yourself might not have wished to have unleashed. What I mean is that your own interest in literary ideas, etc., unleashed some extremes which we in Britain look upon, and that's what I was really alluding to about the divisions within the other side. Because
right.
I mean, I think, and I say this in relation to your question about whether we have a particular view, because we across from here
sometimes look at some of what our colleagues in America do and just sort of say, well, what are they doing?
Well, I do too. That is true. I don't know that I unleash it. As I say, that's one of the arguments I used to have with Ernest. Ernest used to hold me responsible. And I didn't really want to take that role. But it is true that when you start something, you can't tell where it's going to go. And it is, there is a wing of, if you want, postmodern, post-structuralist, post-everything, post-neo-neo, post-post stuff, for which I have rather little use and have been critical of and have had tension with some of them, even been my students. So that goes on, but that's a different kind of thing than the other thing I was talking about. And I must say, at the moment, I'm a little bit more optimistic. The worst of that may be over, but it's hard to know because it could be self-defeating, and it is true that you can start things that you don't want to see go the way they go, and then you say, my God, how am I going to do? So, you keep saying, well, you know, there are facts, and there are things to do, and so on. And more recently, there's been this stuff has been combined with a kind of political militancy, which I share the political values, but not the notion that anthropology should be militant in that sense, that it should, that it's supposed to spend most of its time in the street rather than in the field, which is not my view of things. And that does make for tensions, right? But that's a different sort of thing. That's sort of the normal course of events. It always, I think probably everybody who ever did anything in anthropology that had any effect was slightly appalled at the results. I mean, that's another. But you're right, I think I do have sometimes. And it's, I remember one of the essays in the series of things on writers called Malinowski's Children, and some of the people said, whom I criticized, they said, well, we're your children. And there was some truth in that response, because there was a kind of feeling of that you were, but I don't approve of it. But that's right, that's true. That's always a kind of...
Okay. No, just I thought when you talk about anthropology on the streets versus anthropology in the field, are you talking about the current kind of arts versus science wars, etc., or are you actually talking, for example, about late 1960s or sort of late 60s, early 70s in the AAA? So just, you know, how do you sort of compare these sort of two points of...
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. I'm talking about anthropology.
Vietnam,
now,
you mean?
I do think there's a kind of... how am I going to put it? Again, it goes back to polemics and the notion of that somehow or other anthropology should be a very, very activist discipline of a certain sort. And I, of course, again, have supported that. I mean, I generally myself am. But it can get to the point where they're not doing anthropology any longer, but just activism. That's, I guess. And I'm talking about the present. I'm not talking about the 60s.
What about, like, anti-Vietnam and all this?
Well, again, anti-Vietnam's good around anti-now. I mean, I was anti-Vietnam very strongly, so, and I am anti the present, which I think is the worst government we've ever had. But that doesn't mean I think anthropology is supposed to be a political action group.
Could I?
We can pursue that. I mean, I just don't know what else to say, except that it with some people, it seems to me, it's turned into a kind of... they choose not to do anthropology, but to do something else. As I say, anthropology in the streets rather than the field, which I'm so happy with.
I wanted to ask you about anthropology in the countries where we do our field work. I've been working in Vietnam, actually, and in the anthropology department in Hanoi University, there is a debate going on about what the future of anthropology might look like after Marxism or after Marxist anthropology. And I'm wondering if you've taken an interest very much in how your own ideas have been received.
Yes.
In Indonesia, among anthropologists and other social scientists, whether you were surprised by some of the ways in which social scientists in Indonesia engage with what you've done, perhaps transform some of your ideas.
Yeah, in both countries it has been, but let me talk about Indonesia, which is everything that I've written on Indonesia has been translated into Indonesian. People who don't like or do like, let's say, I've invented the place. I mean, it's, you know, they teach it at Muhammadiyya high schools. I mean, you know, all kinds of strange things happen.
Well, I go to a village and I say, you know, Clifford.
Yeah, that's right. It's very true. I really am a... I mean, I don't want to self referential, but at least an imaginative figure of some sort there, which is not necessarily me, but it's... I guess it was in the 80s sometime. I went back to Pari, where I'd spent years. And I got there, and they had just translated a book, the last book of mine that had been translated, I guess, at that time. They had translated everything else. And people argue about Raghavan and Santri Priyahi all the time. I mean, they interpret the contemporary present-day election in the Eastern. I mean, it is really quite... could be flattery in a sense, but it's nervous-making in other ways. But anyway, I had arrived, and they just translated a small book of mine that you probably don't know, called Socialist of an Indonesian Town, which was a history of Pari from 1906 to when I was there, 56, 60. And it had just been translated into Indonesian. I arrived in the town, and one of my oldest informants was still alive. He was in his 80s. He had gotten a hold of the book. And, of course, I had changed all the names to protect the guilty, as you usually do. And he went in and wrote the right names in it, and this was a Xerox revolution. He went around and Xeroxed all the pages and distributed them around the whole town. So every place I went to see old friends, they brought out this Xerox copy of this thing. Luckily, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a devastating attack on the town. But it was, you know, some things they didn't care for. But you have this feeling of being... and every time I've been back in recent years... it's in the newspapers, they interview, you have a kind of role, which is extraordinary. That's the first side of it. The other side of it is, when I first went to Indonesia, there was essentially one or two Indonesian anthropologists of any kind of stature. There was Kuncharam, and then God who had studied Yale and was just beginning to work, one or two others. Now there are dozens. I mean, there are many, many. I mean, there's a real establishment, and so you're no longer... and that's quite a difference. And it is true that you you do feel that you're sort of yourself being reflected back all the time in these ways. And of course, because I wrote about things which are extremely divisive in Indonesia, Islam, Muhammadiyah, kind of the 65, there's the whole business. I mean, the whole... it's been tremendously... my work has become a public discussion center of things. I mean, there are critiques of it by Muslim modernists, for example, and so on, you know, who really think that this is not where they want to go. Others who think it's great. Or, I mean, you know, you get all these different businesses. So it is very odd, the innocence of the first, when I went there in the 50s, of course, I was just a young guy, and didn't know anybody, and there weren't any other anthropologists, essentially. There were no Indonesian anthropologists, essentially. Even Kuhn started work then. So there was it's just an entirely different situation. And, you know, you get interviewed by the newspapers, and I was there, of course, several times during the Suharto period, and one of the things that happened then was that, because they can't say what they want to say in the newspaper, they want to get you to say it. So you get all these journalists who come and ask you these leading questions like, you know, isn't Suharto a son of a bitch? If you say yes, next day there's a headline, you know, American specialist says Suharto is a son of a bitch. And you have to be very careful. I mean, that's the crudest form of it, but they can be subtler than that. You have to be very careful. So it's an entirely changed situation for someone who is, if I may say, as prominent by now in Indonesian studies as I am. And it's true to the same degree in Morocco, not at the same degree, but also in Morocco. You have to, people know what you've said. Intellectuals do, but even, as I say, as an example from, even ordinary people know something about it. And it's an odd experience, that's what I can say. I don't know what else to say, except, and it's also possible that people, you know, you hear that, you know, people say, well, during 65, somebody said, some general said, Gertz said that all Muslims all the Abahans were a bunch of, you know, yeah, you could kill them. I mean, that they weren't really, they were all atheists and so on, which is not what I said, but that's all right. You can't stop people from saying you said it. And it makes for moral ambiguities and dilemmas. And it means that you can never be an innocent anthropologist again.
But isn't that in a way your answer to your militant who drops his anthropology altogether, which is that I think a real anthropologist is somebody who is critically engaged,
yeah.
And you live by what you say, but you don't you maintain a critical position, not a critical in the pejorative sense, but an analytical position.
Against anthropology, which
yes.
has an edge.
Yeah,
It's just that it doesn't get to be anthropology anymore.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the alternative is simply to keep thinking, keep writing, keep going.
Well, and you have no choice. I say it's true in Morocco too. You're just plunged into the middle of it, especially because I write about things that are of relevance. I mean, you know, I guess if I wrote about initiation ceremonies or something, that it wouldn't happen. But I don't. I write about politics.
Because there is a bit of a difference between your work on Java and your work on Bali. The Javanese stuff has always struck me as being engaged with the politics going on in Java at the time you were writing, particularly the way that you discuss the history of Islam there, and so on and so forth. And I've always found less to criticise in that. But when it comes to the work on Bali, that seems to be less engaged with the politics of Bali at the time.
Well, I think that may be true, and there may be some good reason for it. One of which, you have to remember, that was the period when there were no politics in Bali. This was the time when Sukarno had left the UN. There were no other Europeans on the island but Hilly and I at that time. And everything was in a total suspended state. I've often, been sort of criticized by not, but I, this was before this massacres, before, this is where I was there in 56, 57.
Yeah.
And I did talk, in spite of all that, I did talk about factionalization and about the way in which everything goes back to 1960. That's a long story. But it was a time in which, as far as Bali was concerned, politics was suspended. It was existing in a... And it didn't last long, but for that interlude, Bali was really quite isolated. There were no foreigners. There were no tourists. There was an enormous amount of factualization, and I did try to talk about. That's what I tried to do in the Kinship book and some other books, and I did in the state thing, which has political implications, I think. So I wouldn't say that there's no politics. But I agree with you that it wasn't like Java, but that's, again, anthropology is always of a time and a place. And this was not just, it was not a time when Bali politically was all that interesting. I mean, in terms of Indonesia, it just wasn't. It was very isolated. It's hard to believe what it was like. But I, you're probably right. I maybe should have done more. But I really feel it does reflect somewhat the what was going on there. It was a time between times in Bali.
Yes, it certainly got a lot rougher after you left.
Thank you.
Were you able to keep up with developments in Indonesia after you left?
I went back, of course, and just get out again.
What was it like? Now I can just. Read the Bali Post and Compass on the net every day if I want to. And there,
I went back to Bali after the massacres. Yeah. To talk to a lot of people I knew and what had happened in Tingon, where I worked, one of the places I went. 50 houses were burned. Families were burned in one. The thing about this is a little bit of a side. In the contrast between Bali and Java. In Java, it's very hard to figure out exactly what went on. In Bali, all the killings were grammatical. I couldn't have predicted the killings, but if I was told that they were going to happen, I could have told the killings, because they were all according to factions that have been in place since 1906, in this town, in this village. Everything was exactly according to the kinds of lines that had always been there. And so I did try to uncover that and try to figure out what the attitudes and feelings were. And I went to Java, did the same thing. So I did try to reconstruct it. And I would like to actually talk to you at length sometime about what I think happened in Bali. I hate to do it just off the top of my head because it's a little irresponsible. But I do think that Bali and Java were quite different in the massacres. And that there's something about Balinese social structure and social organization that made it. The massacres really they really come from Java and they invade Bali. It's not a Balinese region. And just how that happened is a long story. But I must say, if you had been there in 56, 57, you would see a society which I thought at that time, and did describe as being very taut in terms of factions and divisions, and billions of divisions. But unlike Java, not deeply unsettled. It just wasn't. At least I didn't think it was. I mean, it's just been imperceptive, but I don't think so. Now, how that happened, but I think there's a tendency when people talk about 65, to identify Java and Bali too closely. I think what happened, I mean, there were killings in both places, that's certainly true, but they happened differently, and they had different kinds of origins. Now, that's about as far as I would want to go without trying to sit down and read or get down in some more detail. But as we're not writing about politically in 56, 57, I still don't see it. I don't see what I would have said. Okay. I did talk a little about party politics and so on, but they were still very lineage organized then.
Can I ask the sister question to Susan's question about perception? Because the sister question to Susan's question about reception. I'm a historian, and we have a joke, as I'm sure you know, in history, which is to say that if people, historians, like to pretend they know about anthropology, they generally cite your work. They claim that if a historian has read some of your work, that they have some credentials in anthropology. And this must be a very...
Hardly my fault.
Sorry.
Hardly my fault, but go ahead.
No, but I mean, in the spirit of Susan's question,
yeah.
I think it is a... because there are very few people who have this kind of capacity. And as someone who's not just a practicing historian, but who tries to write about how history is practiced, I'm very curious to know what you think about it. And I was telling a friend who's a literary critic that this event was happening, and he said, oh, but you have to ask just the same question about literary criticism. So there are a very small number of people like you whose work is taken up and used and has, I would say, talismanic qualities for the users. And as an anthropologist, actually, I think that's a very interesting feature of scholarly life, and I'd like to know what it's like to be you in relation to that.
It is, what is, I think, it's hard to answer a question like that without seeming self-contradictory. As I said, I've never really been an ec-anthropologist in the sense of my audience that I write for has never been really essentially anthropologists. I mean, I write them, but it's been for historians and philosophers and literary critics. I was trained as a philosopher and a literary critic. I write what I consider to be a general academic intellectual audience, not a professional audience. I'm not an anthropologist and don't want to be one. I'm not turning my back on my profession, I'm not doing that, but I've always regarded myself as marginal to it, and determined to be marginal, not that I've been marginalized. I probably could have been a good great professor, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be somebody. Well, I wanted to be a writer. I've always wanted to be a writer. I consider myself a writer, essentially. With anthropology having been the accidental subject that I stumbled into to write about, and rather than the other way around. So I've always tried to write for historians and literary critics and other intellectuals, as well as anthropologists, sociologists, and so on. But I've never been the kind of person who wants to write. So I'm pleased that there's been a kind of resonance, but that doesn't mean I'm pleased with everything that resonates. But it's what I intended to do, so I can't really complain about it. I really did. And I worked, you know, I taught for several years. I've taught a seminar with Bob Darnton, French historian, on history and anthropology at Princeton. I've worked with people like Natalie Davis. I've worked with psychologists. I've worked with philosophers. My interests are, in some ways, being very philosophical. So that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a writer. I still want to be a writer. That's what I think I am, good or bad or indifferent. That's, if you ask me what Bound Deep I think I am, that's what I would say. And it happens that my subject is anthropology. That was more or less accidentally incurred. And I'm pleased. I mean, I enjoy anthropology. And I think it's a great profession to be in. But I've never been a intramural anthropologist. I just don't have any interest in that.
But we can follow that up by talking about a methodological move that people often make, which you might have views about, mm-hmm. which is to transpose time and place. So it seems to me, and I hope you're pleased how widely read. That's what I gather you to be saying.
Very pleased to be read.
But you might.
And there's a marvelous line from Hilary Bellet: "When he is dead, let it be said his skins are scarlet, but his books are read." I'm always in favour of that.
But you might also have a different response to the idea that we take anthropological work and change the main variable. And it seems to me, for those of us who are historians or literary critics, and indeed for those of you who are anthropologists, you may want to have a kind of, well, you may want to have actually some control over those variables. And it does seem to me, it was very interesting to me as a non-anthropologist to hear you all describing what you think the department is about. Because obviously between cultures, there are certain kinds of transpositions. But I think historians actually are increasingly anxious about certain kinds of transpositions. And the comparison that comes to mind is someone like Michael Baxendall, who's incredibly widely read and much loved and very much admired, but who is always saying, okay, here I'm writing about 15th century Italy, and there may be a methodology here that you can use, but don't just transpose 15th century Italy into something else. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious whether you have those kinds of
perspectives
too.
Well, because I've written about Baxendall's work, as you may know. I mean, I've written about his stuff when trying to talk about art. I don't think it's a matter. I think that actually, as I see, just talking about history, because I do know a little about that because I have so many historian friends and I've taught some. Insofar as I have had an impact on history, it is to be to make it more culturally aware than it was, perhaps. Mm. And that I think, but that I don't know quite how to answer your question, because you can't. You're quite right. In the same way as asked the other question about what about local resonances, you can't control them. Mm. You just write, and then you answer to whatever anybody says about them. But there's no way you can control the reception of your work. All you can do is do with what you. My own sense is that, first place, the relationship with history has not been one way. It's not just been by. I've been very influenced by Natalie and by Bob Darnton, by a lot of other people. The whole history of the mentalities business, the whole Rodelian stuff. I'll talk a little bit about again the other day. But so it hasn't been just a one way business. It's been an involvement with them. It is true that you can get reductive transpositions of your work, and say this, but by and large, I don't know. I think in general, I'm sort of pleased by my reception of my work and history in response to it. But I don't know it all. That's the other thing. You just keep coming across it.
My question is actually kind of related to that, because I was struck. Alan mentioned, you know, mentioning one thing in your work that struck us, and I thought Negara, the Theatre State, was a particularly interesting piece. I mean, I found that enormously kind of stimulating and exciting, actually. So your kind of notion of power in the service of pomp rather than pomp in the service of power and so on was, I thought, inspiring. And it struck me that a lot of your work, when it works, is about kind of generating inspirational kind of revelations of various sorts. And so the question for me is how you think about your audience. What is it that you want your writing to affect in your audience? Because looking over the span, you know, right from some early Peddlers and Princes, which is a sort of modernization parts, to the dependency theory, Java versus Japan, which is rather dependency theory, right through, you know, you've yourself had many different kinds of theoretical approaches and paradigms, which you bring to bear. So, in other words, do you think of your audience as somebody informed, who sets your work alongside a lot of other things they already know, and therefore the revelation, the kind of inspiration you generate, is because people already know, they've looked at things in many conventional ways, and now they can look at it in a new way and find new richness that they hadn't before. And how much do you think it should stand alone? You know, read any book on Bali. Read this one book, The Gara. That'll teach you more than the other kind of classics. How do you think about that?
I put it more the other way around. It's a good example. I mean, if you take Peddler's Prince, a quite different book than The Gara, and so on. Mostly, if you try to see why books took form, you have to look at what was going on in my intellectual life at the time. It's more a response to... Nagara was a response to a contact with people like Quentin Skinner and Jack Plum, people who worked on historians, who worked on the formation of the early modern state, the Burgundian states, and so on, beginning and stuff with Machiavelli and so on that they had done, and this, and various other things of the sort. It was a response to that. At that time, Quentin was at the Institute, other people were there, and knew his work. Peddlers and Princes was written while I was in Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It was developmentalism was in the air, takeoff was in the air, all kinds of stuff was in the air. I had my usual doubts about it and my usual halfway with it, sort of, and so on. So if you want to understand, I don't think so much about audiences explains my work so much. I don't design it for audiences. I hope to have an audience on that, but they're out there, we'll see. But it's the kind of people I was talking to at the time. Whether I was talking to Natalie and Bob, or whether I was talking to Ben Higgins and these people you don't know, but anyway, or whether I was talking to some other kind, and sometimes to Anthropological Times. When I was at Chicago, it was at Childs, and David Actor, and political development, you know, so which led to the New States sort of phase of my. Now these things build on one another, but rather than trying to see why particular works of mine take the particular form they do or the particular fiction they do in terms of an intended audience. I suppose I have an intended audience, but it's not very clear in my mind. You would be better off, I think, one would be better off in seeing what the imaginative community that I was considered myself among at that time was. And because I've been outside the normal structure of academic life, those have changed enormously. In the 50s and the 60s, yes, I was very much involved with developmentalist people at MIT. Later on, very much involved with historical mentalities people. Later on, I mean, all sorts, I mean, go on about this. The ecology thing was more ethnological, but the Julian Stewart work and so on. These things, it's the kind of context out of which the books are written, rather than the context toward which they're directed, that I think explains them, at least explains myself to myself. I'm beginning to get nervous about this because it is so. I don't want to come across as being poor little humble me, but I do find this this business a bit. I just write books, and I do care about matters, and I write them, and they're not all that. So they come out of whatever is going on around me at the time, and I've been in this. I've been fortunate to be. If you think of my career, I started off in a small liberal arts college, which is one of the best in the United States, in my opinion. Went to Harvard at a time when everything was going on. It was a madness, but it was a divine madness. I mean, I don't know, even the social whole business, right after the war, when everything was going on. Then I was at MIT for a while. Then I went to Berkeley for a couple of years. And then I went to Chicago at a time when Chicago was, in my opinion, the best university in the world. I mean, in the United States. Certain kind of chauvinism, but it was an extraordinary place with enormous, extraordinary people of a certain sort. and I had a lot of freedom to work there. And then I went to the Institute for Advanced Study. So, and then got involved with people at Princeton like that, like Bob Darn and so on, and others. And then I got Quentin and so on, all kinds of people who I got a list of a whole dozen. That's much more explanatory of the direction my work has taken than either the immediate context of world history or some intentional audience. Mm-hmm. This is, I don't have an intended audience, but it's very vague. I just write. Writing consists of putting sentences together, and that's what I do.
You talked a lot about writing. How do you write? I remember you, the first time I met you, you said...
Thanks for coming, I appreciate it.
You wrote one sentence.
Yeah, well, I write by hand. I have a prescribed this, but I do not advise this. I think it's the worst way to do anything. But it has to do with my obsessive personality. But I write by hand, and I don't write drafts. I just write a couple of sentences. I type it up used to be on a typewriter, now on a computer. And then I correct that, and I move back and forth. Then I move forward, usually paragraph by paragraph. And when I have 25 pages of paragraphs, it's over. And it's not a way to write, but it has a very cause of obsessiveness. And I'm terribly concerned with writing. It's much. When I taught, I haven't taught that much, but I did teach in Chicago and in Berkeley, and a little bit of Princeton too. I always tried to tell students that writing was important. It's not an add-on. That's the really. Yeah, if you're going to be a good writer, you have to want to. It has to be an independent value. You have to think that it's worth doing. Writing well is worth doing. It's not just an add-on. And I used to tell them, they would produce, and they still do it. I mean, you're talking about postmodern stuff. Worse than the worst thing is they just produce jargon and stuff, which you can't. And I used to say to them, Talkin' Parsons can get away with that because he's a professor at Harvard. But if you write like this, no one's going to read you. Just nobody's going to read. I would try to make it about as practical and down-to-earth and as self-interested as I could. But the students then, at least when I had them, it was very hard to convince them of something that I was convinced of from birth, that writing is independent value of itself, that something well-written is good as such. It's not an add-on, it's not a cosmetic, it's not just something that makes things pleasant, it's not just, it is in itself a central value, and that if you develop that, you'll find that it, quote, as I used to try to argue, it'll pay off, you'll get tenure. Whereas if you write like this, you just won't do it. So I write with great care and concern. Whether I write well or not, I don't know, but I want to, certainly. That's what I want. To me, as I say, I consider myself essentially a writer, and I try to work very hard at trying to be clear, to be elegant, to be rhetorically persuasive. I don't find all these things bad things.
That makes your article on Evans Pritchard in Works and Lives even more mysterious, because to be clear, to be persuasive, to be elegant is exactly what he was. And you tried to demolish him on the basis of that one article in Cairo.
Well, I don't think I really tried to demolish him, but I know what you're saying. I didn't say that I thought any one prose style was necessary. Clarity, force, and ease is one sort of... I don't regard that. That's true. I don't regard... Proust wasn't clear. Henry James wasn't clear. I mean, that's not what good prose necessarily is. Clarity is great. Second, I would really object a little bit that I was trying to demolish Evans Pritchard. I thought that was an appreciative art, but it struck a note, I suppose, here that it was. But it wasn't. It was. It is the notion of a certain notion of what English prose should be that I wanted to question as being the only way to do things, and to put it in the context of the way Lévi-Strauss writes, the way Benedict writes, and so on. But I wasn't trying to demolish anybody. I may sound that way, and maybe I was in my hardest heart, but I don't really think so. I was trying to snook at what the notion of what, of a rather narrow notion of what good writing is. I guess I would.
And what you seem to be objecting to was, as you described, it's Oxbridge Common Room talk, a sort of easy assertion that this is how the world is.
Right.
And that is a legitimate criticism, that, you know, there's no criticism of Evans Pritchard. You know, he just says this is how it is, and you know, you either say he's talking nonsense or you have to agree with him. There's no halfway between things, and I can see how, from your point of view, that would be irritating. And
well, it was not anything. I think Evans Pritchard writes pretty well. Mm. If you got the view from that thing that I didn't think highly of his prose, actually, I would have chosen. I chose again because I'm conservative. Right, I only chose people I thought wrote well.
Yes.
They don't write the same. Levi Strauss doesn't write that way, and Malosky didn't write that way, and Benedict didn't write that way. I guess that's true. Yes, I had this sort of, there's a kind of
Olympian
authoritarianism that's involved that I just wanted to at least put a little wedge into, but not really demolish. I think that Evans Pritchard was a superb writer. If you want to know my actual opinion, that didn't come across. That's a shame. But I did want to get away from the notion of that this is the only way to write. And there was a kind of assumed authority that I think...
well, the other thing that was surprising...
Olympian kind of quality to it all that I found.
Was that, A, that you took, you know, some rather peripheral article of his in some obscure journal as the citation. If you'd taken the newer of the Azandi, because in many ways he was doing exactly what you do best, which is combining analysis with ethnography and making them combined in a way where you can't really tell whether he's being an ethnographer or an analyst, as you do in many of your best articles. And therefore he was, seems to be someone I would have thought you would have admired in many ways.
I do admire him, and that's what it puzzles me always. I guess you can't critique him. I could criticize everybody in that. I mean, I was trying to show that what I guess I do critique, and that is the assumption that this is the truth. That's right, I didn't. But I do admire his work, and actually I didn't really depend on that. I think the new era is written in the way I said it was written. There is a kind of hyper-clarity, a kind of lack of shading, a lack of bewilderment, a lack of complexity that I find you get in some other writers more so, but then there you could say that clearly. But I wasn't, and again, in that book, I wasn't trying to recommend a particular way of writing, mine or anybody else's, but trying to say, which is something the anthropologists have never done before, and still even after it happened, as much as I think they do, is reflect on the way they write, rather than just accept the sort of the Evans Pritchard sort of notion, or the notion that often accepted, that this is a clear view window on reality. That I'm just telling you as it is, and this is it. It's clear, and it's apodictic, and this is how it is. And the lineages work this way, and that works that way, and it's all that. There's no very little reflection on that. This is rhetorical. This, as we all are, that my work is rhetorical, and Malinowski's is rhetorical, and Benedict's rhetorical, and the devices of rhetoric vary. There is very little, still, book reviews in anthropology consist in whether somebody agrees with what they consider the substance of the argument. The notion of how anthropological books are put together, how they're constructed, what kind of literary form and literary possibilities there are, is still not very strong. And that's all I was trying to do. I think in Evans Pritchard's case, there's a little bit of retrospective, you know, who's he to sort of pick on the great man. But I wasn't trying to pick on. I think Evans, just as long as we're here, Evans Pritchard was a great anthropologist. He wrote with superb quality. But it's not the only way to do things, and it's not beyond critique. It's not beyond reflection on the fact that it was a constructed text, that it is rhetorical, and that it comes out of a particular subject position. Whether that's the English common room or what or not, that maybe I'm